Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, who examines the efforts to prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the viable options for containing or reversing Iran's and North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Bob Williams, Director of the Politics of Oil Project at the Center for Public Integrity, who discusses the power and influence of big oil in U.S. politics. And Jane Goodall, the internationally known chimpanzee researcher, who talks about what she has learned about animal behavior and the degradation of the environment threatening all life on Earth. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that fear and violence have taken hold in Haiti in advance of elections scheduled for October and November. Supporters of ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, forced out in a coup on February 29, 2004, fear for their lives and many are afraid to leave their homes. Meanwhile, right-wing parliamentary leader Guy Philippe, who was trained by the U.S. Special Forces in the 1990s, has started his own political party, the Front for National Reconstruction. For the last year, foreign peacekeepers, including 6,700 mostly Brazilian soldiers, have patrolled the island with a United Nations mandate to aid U.S.-installed Prime Minister Gerard Latortue. A human rights report by Philadelphia immigration lawyer Thomas Griffin criticized Haitian police for fueling recent violence. More than 400 people have died since last September in clashes between pro-government and pro-Aristide members of the Lavalas party. In recent months, Haitian radio has whipped up a frenzy against Lavalas. The Press Owners Lobby, the National Association of Haitian Media, is an active member of the Group of 184, an anti-Aristide faction that received funding from the U.S. International Republican Institute. One of the founders of Tele-Haiti, the island's main TV station, is factory owner André Appé Jr., who led the campaign against Aristide's efforts to double the minimum wage. With finances from the World Bank over the last three decades, massive shrimp farms have taken over fragile mangrove forests in Latin America. In Ecuador, coastal shrimp farms grew 20-fold from 1979 to 1985, with exports bound for fancy restaurants to wealthy consumers in the United States, Japan, and Europe. But today, the coast of Ecuador is littered with polluted shrimp farms. The boom came to Honduras a decade later. For 15 years, eco-activist Jorge Varela, a winner of the 1999 Goldman Environmental Prize, has campaigned to stop the degradation caused by shrimp farms, which rely on chemicals and cheap labor to grow millions of shrimp in contained pools. Closed shrimp farms have left behind polluted waters in nations like Thailand, Vietnam, Brazil, and Mexico. According to Public Citizen, the export-driven shrimp farms have undercut traditional shrimping operations off the coasts of North Carolina, Maine, and California. Since 2000, the value of the U.S. shrimp catch has fallen by 50%. Now, 90% of all shrimp eaten in the U.S. is imported. Public Citizen warns that due to the ever-increasing demand for low-cost shrimp products, farm-raised shrimp is harming not only the environment, but also consumers' health. Mother Jones magazine reports that an asthma clinic van is doing brisk business on the west side of Chicago. In poor minority neighborhoods, parents stay up late worrying about the next asthma attack of their children, which might result in a trip to the emergency room. All four of Tanisha Ammon's sons have asthma, which means their breathing airways are chronically inflamed. Attacks can often be triggered by warmer weather, dust mites, or smoke. Often, a severe asthma attack can deplete the lungs of oxygen. 5,000 people die each year from asthma attacks. For many, care comes too late. A study by a coalition of health groups revealed that a quarter of all children with asthma end up in the emergency room. In Illinois, asthma attacks are the number one reason that children go to the hospital. Increasingly, health agencies are hiring community outreach workers to detect the urban triggers for asthma attacks. At the Robert Taylor Homes, a Chicago public housing complex, two women go door to door to take preventative measures, like handing out caulking guns and teal wool to fill rodent holes and mattress covers to stop dust mites. There is also fear among researchers at Harvard University that global warming may be increasing asthma rates. Warmer weather tends to increase pollen and mold spores into the environment. Children are particularly vulnerable to this urban toxic brew of pollen, mold, and pollution produced by cars and buses. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Since coming into force in 1970, signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty have made a commitment to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and weapons technology. In early May, delegates from 187 nations convened the 7th NPT five-year review conference at UN headquarters in New York. There, delegates will address the treaty's prohibition on non-nuclear states from acquiring atomic weapons and the obligation of five nuclear-armed states, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, and China, to negotiate the elimination of their own nuclear arsenals. Only India, Pakistan, and Israel, states that now possess nuclear weapons, have refused to sign the treaty. In recent years, the focus of the world has been on the nuclear ambitions of North Korea and Iran. The Bush administration has used a combination of diplomacy and the threat of military force to prevent these two nations from acquiring nuclear weapons. But while much of the world opposes North Korea's and Iran's efforts to obtain nukes, many nations are critical of the White House rejection of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and withdrawal from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty with Russia. Some world leaders also maintain that President Bush's efforts to modernize America's nuclear warheads and budgeting of funds to design new battlefield nuclear weapons undermines the Non-Proliferation Treaty and could trigger a new global nuclear arms race. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, who examines the viable options for containing or reversing Iran and North Korea's nuclear ambitions.
Iran is a party to the NPT, and it has become known over the last few years that for about 20 years it has been working towards acquiring the capability to enrich uranium. That, in fact, is something which it is entitled to do under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because the Non-Proliferation Treaty, unfortunately, guarantees all countries access to nuclear power and promises them assistance with nuclear power. I say it's unfortunate because nuclear power is the foundation for nuclear weapons programs. So Iran could have built up its uranium enrichment capability openly and transparently and been in compliance with the treaty. For whatever reason, they chose to conceal the fact on a large scale, not talking about small-scale concealment of their program to get this uranium enrichment capability. So as this has come to light, the Bush administration, not without reason, has said the only reason they would conceal this effort is because they eventually want to be in the position to make nuclear weapons should they decide to do so. And the Bush administration is saying that because it concealed this program, it should have to halt it and never have the capability to enrich uranium or separate plutonium. Now, that's the nature of the dispute. If you've been reading about this in the paper, you know that there are negotiations going on between three European countries and Iran where they're trying to put together a package of economic incentives and security guarantees, and Iran agreeing to halt its enrichment program. Then probably how the Iran situation is going to develop is that It's going to go before the IAEA Board of Governors in June, and then the Bush administration may try to get it referred to the Security Council. You probably know that there have been reports of contingency plans for military operations circulating in the Bush administration, and even according to Seymour Hersh, covert surveillance operations being carried out in Iran. So it's a situation we have to watch very closely, because, you know, I certainly don't think in my organization's position is that war is not the answer. So that's Iran. North Korea has announced its withdrawal from the NPT and has announced that it has nuclear weapons, and there's concern now that they are going to test a nuclear weapon. So this is really a severe challenge to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which, you know, some impressions to the contrary, has worked pretty well over the years, helping to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. But if North Korea becomes entrenched as a nuclear weapon country, that's going to put pressure on Japan to acquire nuclear weapons or to militarize further. It's really going to be destabilizing.
What, in your view, are some alternatives that the U.S. and the community of nations as a whole could take to avoid military confrontation and at the same time draw back both Iran and North Korea from the development of nuclear weapons?
First of all, you know, I don't think any country should have nuclear weapons. But if you look at this from the point of view of North Korea, the United States has had a threat of first use of nuclear weapons against North Korea for about five decades. It's always been U.S. policy that if North Korea invaded South Korea, that the United States could or would respond with nuclear weapons. So, you know, North Korea could logically think, well, if the United States and South Korea need nuclear weapons for their self-defense, then we need them for our self-defense. I have what may sound like a simplistic answer regarding North Korea, but I actually think it's true. That would be give North Korea what it wants. North Korea wants an end to the state of war that has existed with the United States since the 1950s. North Korea wants economic relations. It wants diplomatic relations. That's what it wants. It sort of wants to be brought into and recognized as a country that everybody can do business with, but particularly the United States.
And what about Iran? How would you suggest the U.S. and the international community deal with Iran and their seeming efforts to develop nuclear weapons?
Right. Well, I would say that they, under U.S. pressure, the European countries have now said that they want Iran to permanently halt its uranium enrichment program. And that doesn't seem to be something that Iran really wants to do. You know, there's a lot of national pride involved here, for one thing. And it's not clear to me that Iran is going to agree to a permanent halt in its enrichment program. So it looks like there's some sort of confrontation coming down the road, but it shouldn't be a military one. That's just not the way to solve problems in today's world. It's too dangerous.
That was John Burroughs, Executive Director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. Contact the committee by calling area code 212-818-1861 or visit their website at www.lcnp.org. As the price of gasoline and heating oil skyrocketed over the past year, frustrated consumers are wondering if the big oil companies' record profits have been made at their expense. Increased international demand for oil products that has pushed up the price of crude in world markets is offered as one explanation, but some industry analysts have growing suspicions that big energy companies may be engaged in price gouging. While those charges have yet to be proven, there is no doubt that the big oil companies have bought enormous influence in Washington through millions of dollars spent on campaign contributions and lobbying. A recent study conducted by the Center for Public Integrity found that the oil industry has spent more than $380 million on lobbying activities since 1998, working primarily to influence the development of a new national energy policy and gain tax breaks. The industry also gave over $67 million in campaign contributions to candidates since 1998, providing Republicans with over 73% of those funds. President Bush, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, and House Speaker Dennis Hastert are among the biggest recipients of oil company largesse. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bob Williams, Director of the Politics of Oil Project at the Center for Public Integrity, who discusses the power and influence of big oil in U.S. politics.
Big oil is always trying to find ways to get regulations on exploration loosened. They're trying to get environmental regulations loosened so they can drill for more oil in the United States. I mean, the one that really jumps to the top of the list is they want to drill in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR. It's been a very controversial issue. They also, they just try to get, whatever tax breaks, whatever incentives they can, just like any other industry does. The thing with big oil is it has a lot of friends in Washington, particularly within the current administration, and they certainly spend a great deal of money both in campaign contributions and in lobbying, direct lobbying to get what they need or get what they want.
How much money are we talking about in terms of the biggest oil companies? What are they investing in terms of U.S. politics?
Well, what we found was that the big five, Exxon, Chevron, Texaco, BP, Royal Dutch, and Total, which is a French company, that they had spent $381 million on lobbying activities since 1998. They'd also given $67 million in campaign contributions in just federal elections. I think what we were really surprised about was the fact that the lobbying outweighed the campaign contributions by about 5-1. So they're definitely, hiring a lot of lobbyists and have a lot of lobbyists in-house that work for them as well.
Could you name some of the largest recipients in Congress of big oil money in terms of campaign contributions?
Absolutely. They wouldn't be surprising to most folks. Tom DeLay, right there at the top of the list. And he's certainly got a great deal of money from the oil companies over the years. Most of it's gone to Republicans, by a factor of pretty much 3-1 over the years. And that's for all the years that we studied. Other folks that you would expect would get Joe Barton of Houston gets a great deal of money. He's a congressman from down that way. Most of the senators, representatives from Texas, most of the senators, representatives from Louisiana get a great deal of oil money.
What can you tell us about how closely this administration is working with big oil companies to draft legislation vis-a-vis the secret meetings that were subject of some controversy between the oil companies and the vice president's office?
Like most folks, we didn't get an invitation to come and sit in on the energy policy task force that Mr. Cheney put together. But we were able to kind of pull the sheets back a little bit on an organization called the National Petroleum Council, which is basically a group of oil executives that provide advice to the administration. And the guy who was in charge of putting together their energy plan, which was presented to the administration, was Dick Cheney, who worked for Halliburton at the time. Well, I think it's fair to say that the industry wrote most of what was in the energy plan. There's a reason that Mr. Cheney doesn't want anybody to know what happened in those meetings, and it was the fact that the industry was invited, environmentalists were not. And they wrote this policy that in many ways had been drafted by Mr. Cheney and his friends when they were in the private sector.
How have the big energy companies influenced our government's policy when it comes to subsidizing big oil and other energy companies' exploration for new sources of energy?
Well, there's a whole array of tax breaks that the oil companies already get to supposedly encourage exploration and development. And we have another energy bill that's coming up this year. There would be tax breaks in that, in the order of billions of dollars And the last energy bill, which actually ended up dying in Congress due to a filibuster late last year, that had about $18 billion worth of tax breaks of various incentives for the oil industry.
How do you assess the value of those subsidies in terms of taxpayer-funded subsidies that go to companies that have giant profit margins? Is that a necessity? We often hear about the magic of the market. Is it really necessary that taxpayers help out the big oil companies?
Well, it's a bit disingenuous if the oil companies are contending right now that they need these kind of tax breaks. They are reporting, you know, quarter after quarter, they're rewriting their records for profits with the way things are right now with oil prices and gas prices. So to be crying poverty at this point is a bit ridiculous.
That was Bob Williams, director of the Politics of Oil Project at the Center for Public Integrity. Contact the center by calling area code 202-466-1300 or visit their website at www.publicintegrity.org. Jane Goodall is the internationally known chimpanzee researcher who began her work 45 years ago in the forests of Gombe in what is now known as Tanzania. Goodall travels around the world 300 days a year, addressing what she and other researchers have learned about animal behavior, the degradation of the environment threatening all life on Earth, and growing efforts to combat environmental ills. On May 10th, Dr. Goodall spoke to an enthusiastic audience of several hundred adults and children at Yale University. She talked about her research and how her work has evolved over the decades through the Jane Goodall Institute to encompass projects that directly benefit the local human population of the region in Africa where she works.
One of the chimpanzees had begun to lose his fear of me. I named him David Greybeard. He had this beautiful white frill of hair on his chin. And one day, just after my mother had gone, I was walking through the vegetation, and I saw this dark shape crouched over a termite mound. And that was the first time I saw this termite fishing behavior, using a piece of grass as a tool, stripping off leaves, and thus making a tool. And that was it. I sent a telegram to Louis Leakey, no faxes or emails back then, and told him. And because we were known, as you heard, as Man the Toolmaker, Lewis sent a telegram back saying, now we must redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans. And that was really the first of the breakthroughs that would come from the research at Gombe.
Later in her talk, Goodall explained that deforestation and other environmental ills had devastated not only the chimpanzee population, but also the people who lived in the forest.
One of JGI's programs that I feel most proud of, it's called Take Care. It's a very holistic program to improve the lives of the people living in the villages, these people living in desperate poverty. The program began with funds from the European Union, and we just tried it out in 12 villages, going in, asking the villagers what they felt they most needed, listening to them, planning the project. Never was there more than one European. The rest were always Tanzanians, a team of skilled Tanzanians who went out into the villages and talked to the people. And this has led to a program which has at its heart growing trees. First of all, those that will bring immediate profit to the people, fruit trees, fast-growing species for timber and charcoal and so forth. Then moving on to the indigenous trees, farming methods most suitable to help control and prevent the terrible soil erosion, methods for reclaiming over-farmed sterile land so that once again it can be used, working with particularly groups of women, helping to improve their self-esteem and their education, providing microcredit opportunities, that's the opportunity to take out tiny loans for environmentally sustainable development programs, even if you start with no money at all. It's based on the Grameen Bank system. offering scholarships to gifted girls so that they can go on to secondary school, because most girls don't, offering information about family planning, AIDS education, and women's rights, concentrating on women, because all over the world it's been shown that as women's education increases, family size begins to drop. And that is desperately important in this very poor part of Tanzania, and it's working. Take Care is offering hope. Now the villagers are agreeing, many of them, to stop hacking at the stumps of the trees that once were there, the stumps that look so dead. And if they stop hacking at them for firewood, which they don't need to anymore because there's woodlots near the village, in 5 years, these trees can be 20 or 30 foot high. And other aid organizations are putting money in much greater quantities so that we can provide fresh water and hygienic latrines and things of this sort. And so our hope is that now the people, the local people, are our partners. Now they're agreeing to let the trees grow, and our chimpanzees may be able to use leafy corridors to make contact with other small remnant groups. We don't know if it will work, but we have to try. My hope is perhaps simplistic, but I feel it very strongly, and there are four reasons for hope. First, it's the young people themselves. And my second reason is this extraordinary brain of ours. You know, finally around the world, we're admitting that we really have messed things up, we really have harmed the environment, and so there are all these new technologies being developed. If only we would go out and buy them, get them, use them, we'd already be harming the environment much less, living in greater harmony. My third reason is the resilience of nature, and you all know places that we destroyed, rivers that are filthy and polluted, forests, woods that are being cut down. Give them time, give them help. Sometimes we have to help them, and things can be reversed. Last reason for hope is what I call the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle impossible tasks and won't give up.
That was chimpanzee researcher Dr. Jane Goodall speaking at Yale University on May 10th. Goodall's speech was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on Dr. Goodall's projects, including Roots and Shoots, a program for young people now operating in 91 nations, call the Jane Goodall Institute in Silver Spring, Maryland at area code 240-645-4000 or visit their website at www.janegoodall.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.